This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. Inside our virtual space, you and I get briefed together on the big questions of the day by people who know what they're talking about. And you can subscribe to the podcast by downloading the BBC Sounds app. If the show works for you, and especially if it doesn't and you know how it could, tell us what you think by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider. My thanks to Dave at Fernie, RWJ63 and John A. Owen, who've all reviewed us recently. This week, we're talking about Brexit. Theresa May says it's her deal or a danger of no deal. But is she right? And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might enjoy other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available via BBC Sounds. On June 23rd, 2016, Britain voted to leave the EU. On March 29th, 2017, Britain invoked the famous Article 50, setting a deadline of the 29th of March 2019 for leaving. On December 11th, nearly 2.5 years after the referendum and 15 weeks and 3 days before departure, Parliament will vote on the terms of the withdrawal. What happens if Parliament votes the Prime Minister's deal down? Would there be a no-deal departure? And what might that mean? Step into the briefing room where we'll try to find out. Crashing out. Disorderly exit. Whatever we call it, for some, it's a scary prospect.
If we crash out on the 30th of March next year, with no transitional period, within 3 weeks, we will have no fruit and vegetables on English shelves.
By the end of 2023, GDP is more than 10% lower in the disorderly scenario compared to that May 2016 trend.
Crashing out of the European Union without a trade agreement would leave British exporters with more than $6 billion a year of potential extra costs.
In a no deal, pure and simple, there would be a limit, a numerical limit, on the number of British trucks which are allowed to cross into the EU, and quite possibly the same in reverse.
Unemployment rises to 7.5%.
If we were to crash out with a no deal, it's likely we would totally lose access for a period of time.
The sharp fall in sterling, alongside with the imposition of tariffs, pushes up the cost of imports, and overall CPI inflation peaks at 6.6%.
For others, it's less worrying.
There was absolutely no gain to the United Kingdom economy going into this organisation, so I don't expect to see any loss coming out.
We have to not give in to fear, and we have to do the best for the people who rely on us in Parliament to get a good arrangement with the EU.
If you actually look at the numbers, the figures and the forecasts that have been put out, it's very clear that when we come out, we'll be in a much better position.
With the disruption we had during the First and Second World Wars, would a no-deal Brexit really be that bad?
If we have no deal and we trade on current WTO terms, that's the basis that not only that Britain trades with countries like the United States, but that the EU trades with the rest of the world in most circumstances. So it's not exactly a nightmare scenario.
We've set out practical measures to mitigate any risk of disruption to supply.
But what does the best information tell us? One man who knows more than most about this is Tim Durrant. He's a researcher at the Institute for Government, where his specialisation is the no-deal scenario. Tim Durrant, what happens on March the 30th 2019 if there is no withdrawal deal?
What it means if the UK leaves with no deal is that the UK suddenly falls out of the EU framework of legislation, right? Which is something we've been part of for 40 years. So laws that apply in the country currently will no longer apply. And that sounds quite abstract, but it will have a real knock-on effect into sort of many areas of everyday life. The problem with forecasting no deal is that no one knows for certain what it means. It depends on how people in the UK react and how people in the rest of the EU react to that situation.
Now, I want to make a distinction here between, if you like, what will formally happen and then the ways round those things happening. So let's just be clear for a moment, as clear as we can be, what things will no longer happen that did happen before and what things will happen that didn't happen before?
So things that will no longer happen that did happen before are, again, depending on how the EU react. For example, goods crossing the English Channel from the UK to France, Belgium, the Netherlands will be subject to checks in those countries in a way that they aren't currently, because our goods are part of the single market and the EU's customs union. So once we're outside those structures, the EU will be required to check things coming from the UK in a way that they don't currently. Now, obviously, those countries could decide to take some leeway, but legally, formally, they would be required to check those things.
So that being an example, would we, our goods, be subject to tariffs that they weren't subject to before as from the 30th?
In theory, yes. In reality, it's going to be very difficult for those countries to levy those tariffs on day one. And you could imagine that sort of day one, nothing changes perhaps, but it, you know, day 10, day 30, 6 months down the line, will they have the structures in place to charge tariffs, to carry out checks, to make sure that our goods are meeting their standards, probably in a way that they don't need to currently?
Now, for the ordinary British citizen, March the 30th dawns, they go about their business. What changes for them?
The big changes will be those people who experience travel or trade with the EU. So if you're a small business who trades with another EU country, you, if there is no deal, we'll need to be carrying out import and export declarations in a way that you don't need to currently. Your goods going across the channel might be subject to checks. If you want to drive to the EU, currently a British driving licence is valid in all 28 or the other 27 countries of the EU. After we leave with no deal, it may not be. Therefore, you may no longer be able to drive on your British licence. For people who aren't immediately trying to cross into another EU country, either themselves or their business, it will be, I think, a slower impact. But the big concern that people have is that because of these logistical checks, these problems at the border, then there will be a delay in things coming into the UK as well as goods leaving. So, you know, we import a lot of food from the rest of the EU. If there are delays at the border of trucks coming into particularly England through Dover and the Kent ports, then that may slow down how easy it is to get food across the rest of the country. Similarly, medicines, chemicals, things that don't have long shelf lives, you know, they can't just be left in a warehouse somewhere. If there is this clog at the ports, that could slow down the delivery of those kind of items.
How prepared are we and are the EU to deal with the checks that are likely to be up and running, let's say, a few weeks into the process?
So the government has said here that it is not going to levy extra sort of quality checks, extra regulation checks on anything coming in from the EU initially. However, there will still be a need for customs paperwork and potentially, depending on what the government decides, to charge tariffs to the EU. Those goods might need to be charged tariffs. So that could slow things down.
Can I just stop you there? Yeah. Aren't we obliged by WTO rules, I seem to remember from some kind of dim, distant briefing elsewhere, to charge those tariffs?
The government has a choice to make on tariffs. Currently, goods moving within the EU pay no tariffs. It can either continue to charge no tariffs on EU goods, but then under WTO rules, we would be obliged to treat everyone else in the WTO the same, which would mean we would be levying zero tariffs on any of our imports. That might be a good thing, but you would want to give that away in trade negotiations rather than having to do it all at once in one go.
I presume it's part of the argument of those people who think that no deal actually wouldn't be as bad as other people fear, that we could fairly rapidly move to a zero tariff position, both on EU goods and other goods.
The thing about modern trade agreements is that tariffs are only a very small part of them, right? So as we've already spoken about, the regulatory checks are key as well. And it's those kind of non-tariff barriers is what they're called, the sort of checks and extra hassle for businesses trading they add in the costs. It's not necessarily the tariffs themselves.
In macroeconomic terms, we've heard from the Treasury forecast this week that a no-deal Brexit could take as much as 9.3% off the UK's GDP over 15 years. How reliable, and I don't know, this is the $60 million question, how reliable is such economic modelling?
I think the thing with economic modelling, everyone argues is, you know, you get out from a model what you put in, right? These models are based on a set of assumptions because inherently the future is unknowable. So you have to kind of make these assumptions about where things might go, what kind of things might happen. The thing to say, I think, about, so both the Treasury analysis yesterday and the Bank of England show that a no-deal outcome would be the worst outcome for the economy. That is in line with most other studies, right? So academic studies, consultancies, think tanks, you know, various different organisations have done similar studies. They'll each have their own assumptions, their own sort of particular models. But the broad range of results is similar across the piece. There are a couple of outliers, a couple of organisations that think that actually a no-deal best for the economy because of the sort of freedom it gives us away from EU rules, but they are very much in the minority.
Let's say I'm an MP and I'm in some kind of doubt about no deal, and I come to you and I say, look, I've heard everything you've said, I've heard all your caveats, I know you're a very careful person and so on. How strongly would you advise me, however, to try and avoid no deal? What would you say?
Very strongly. While there is a lot of uncertainty, we know that there will be problems. It might not be exactly of the magnitude that people forecast or the exact issues that people focus on, but there will be issues. It is a sort of an overnight collapse of a significant part of the UK's legal structure. And that is going to cause problems, unexpected problems, in a way that, you know, would cause damage to people's everyday lives.
Tim Durrant from the Institute for Government. So that's the no deal as it impacts on Britain. How does it look to the other 27 countries of the European Union? Is no deal an acceptable outcome for them? Are they ready for it? I was joined earlier in the briefing room by Alex Barker, who's the Financial Times bureau chief in Brussels. Alex Barker, what sorts of conversations are going on in Brussels right now about the possibility of a no vote in Westminster?
I think, like us, I think a lot of Europeans have given up trying to understand British politics. So there is naturally a lot of trepidation about what happens after a no vote. They feel like they have pulled together a package that works. They've made the compromises they want to make to ensure a soft landing. And they're now thinking through, what can we tweak to potentially salvage this? And what do we need to do to prepare if this all goes wrong?
Do they think there are things that they could do to help May get her deal through, or a second version of the deal through within a timetable?
Yes. I mean, Jean-Claude Juncker often compares British politics to a dance in eastern Luxembourg where pilgrims line up and go three steps forward and two steps back. And they see British negotiations often on that template. What they would be willing to change is the political declaration, if there is a shift in the political mood in the UK over what kind of future relationship we want. That's a non-binding document. It's easy to do. You could draft it in a night. What they're much more reluctant to do is change the 585-page withdrawal treaty in any significant way that would unsettle the compromises they made between themselves over what kind of Brexit we want.
Do they believe that if the May deal is voted down, that anybody has time to do any new deal before March the 29th?
Never say never in Brussels. They would be potentially willing to change that withdrawal treaty, but you have to meet a very high bar. It has to be a change that is simple to negotiate, that meets their red lines, and that they would have the confidence would genuinely help to bring a majority together in Westminster.
So they are expecting, are they, Westminster now to go for a no vote to the May deal. And at the moment, as things currently stand, that the most likely outcome is a no-deal scenario?
They are looking at the debates in Parliament, thinking a no-deal is likely. I think they probably hope it's close enough as a vote that they can tweak and amend and try to bring the package back in broadly the same form. If it's a thumping defeat, they will have some serious thinking to do over coming weeks.
What do they understand the impact upon European member states of a no deal by the 29th scenario to be?
at a macro level, if you talk to officials in Paris, they will say, well, this would be a hit to our economy, maybe of half a percentage point of GDP. It's manageable. The EU would suffer, but the UK would suffer a lot more. And the EU thinks that it can put into place some measures that would mitigate the worst effects for them.
What kind of forms of mitigation are we talking about?
You can make special arrangements for airlines. So planes are allowed to fly point to point from London to Paris, but not necessarily from Paris to Athens to Rome. You can make special arrangements for financial services. You can change customs requirements for short periods to basically address the fact that they don't have the infrastructure and the people to do the full range of checks that they would be expected to do. But it's really just a bit of anaesthetic for a system that will be under heavy, heavy strain.
And what about the money?
The money is a big issue. The UK roughly would leave a gap of about 10, 12 billion in the EU budget for 2019 and 2020. That would force the EU to accelerate all sorts of nasty decisions that they had been deferring for the years later.
Alex, what about an extension, asking for an extension of Article 50? What do you think their reaction would be to that?
In the treaty, it's very clear that the UK can ask for an extension. That requires unanimity among the 27. And I've not met anyone here that thinks that that would be rejected outright. Second to maintaining unity, one of the main goals of the EU is not to be blamed for Brexit. And I can't imagine circumstances where they would be pushing the UK out onto to no deal in the event that they were coming with a reasonable proposition to either renegotiate or ask for time to have an election or a referendum.
What do you think is the most significant thing that the EU could give to Theresa May to stop a second vote going against her?
One of the parts of this package that actually evolved most through the negotiation, that was hardest to predict at the start of this process, was where we've ended up on the backstop for Northern Ireland. The EU took a decision to have a very clear, watertight, legally binding, complete solution in the withdrawal treaty to ensure there was no border in Northern Ireland. There was a choice at one point to leave some of that open. That would make a huge difference to the politics of how Mrs. May would be selling this in the House of Commons. But I think we've probably gone too far in this negotiation for that to be a realistic outcome now.
Despite all the problems a no deal would cause Europe.
They are worried, but also very confident that the problems that would be created by no deal would be far, far, far worse for the UK, and that ultimately time would be on their side in the days running up to March 29th.
Alex Barker. And of course, as he suggests, there's one country where the effects of a no-deal Brexit will be felt most acutely. Ireland. The spectre of a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic has haunted negotiations from day one. Patrick Smith is the Europe editor of the Irish Times, also based in Brussels. Patrick Smith, how are Irish politicians, when you speak to them privately, looking at this right now?
Irish politicians are very concerned because a no-deal Brexit would certainly create enormous problems for Ireland, and more problems for Ireland, indeed, than any other member state.
Does no-deal automatically mean a hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic?
Well, it's a very good question, and the answer is we don't know. Both the British and Irish governments have said repeatedly that it's not their intention to impose any kind of barriers on the border. The problem is that if you ask the British and the Irish what measures they would take in order to safeguard a frictionless border, they simply won't say. They talk in abstractions about how they don't want a border and they were going to make sure there isn't a border. So the problem is that both the EU and the World Trade Organization are likely to insist on some form of border protection in Ireland, unless the British commit to maintaining a form of regulatory alignment that they seem very opposed to.
This isn't just a question about this constituting an EU border, but also for the World Trade Organization rules, because we can't give preferential treatment to EU goods after we've left the European Union. Britain would be obliged to impose a hard border in Ireland.
Yes, they would be in immediate difficulties with the WTO.
Now, a lot of people have talked about the dangers to the Good Friday Agreement, and it's certainly true, it seems to me, looking back, that the agreement was made much easier by the fact of joint EU membership and the soft border. But now, over 20 years on, is there any real belief that things would slip back just because you have some border posts?
I think that what would happen is that we won't see a return to war by the IRA, but the border posts would undoubtedly become targets for paramilitary dissidents. And there's enough of them with enough arms and ammunition to cause quite a lot of trouble. So I think you would see quite quickly the militarization of a border, which will bring back, really very bad memories.
Now, given all that, isn't Ireland doing everything in its power to get the European Union to be super amenable to solving Theresa May's problems?
Yes, I think that that's true. And it has been supported remarkably by the 27 Remainer states all the way through the negotiations. The problem is that there are limits, and protecting the single market is an absolute priority for a lot of the member states, the French most notably. So they are going to insist that Ireland protects the integrity of the single market by having border controls.
So if a hard border is to be avoided, where does the Irish government think that the European Union could maybe be a bit more flexible?
The Taoiseach the other day said there was no plan B. And I think that's probably very true. I think they're pinning their hopes on this deal going through. And, I mean, that's it, really. It doesn't seem like there is an easy way out of this, a diplomatic way around this particular problem.
Patrick Smith from the Irish Times. Now, just about every clever calculation made about how Parliament will vote on December the 11th, after 5 days of debate and a possible televised confrontation between the PM and the Leader of the Opposition, predicts that Mrs. May will lose. If she does, and cannot get her deal or something like it through the Commons, what happens then? Joining me now in the briefing room, hotfoot from her own briefing at Westminster, is Professor Meg Russell. She's head of the Constitution Unit at University College London. Meg Russell, technically, if Parliament votes against the withdrawal agreement, does that automatically mean that we go to a no deal?
No, absolutely not. People have increasingly been saying in the recent days, right up to the Cabinet, people like Amber Rudd, Keir Starmer has said it for Labour, there is no majority in Parliament for no deal, and Parliament would do whatever it could to try and block a no deal outcome. So I think these votes on the 11th of December are just the beginning of what could prove to be quite a long negotiation with Parliament.
How can Parliament block a no deal exit if, whatever happens, on March the 30th, we're out?
Well, if it gets that far, it can't. But obviously, that date is looming, but it is nonetheless still some months away. And I think there's still all to play for in Parliament, really.
So what you mean is the Parliament can actually instruct the government to do something else?
Well, what you need to remember in the British system is that officially Parliament is sovereign. That means that Parliament is the government's boss, not the other way around, although it sometimes looks like it is the other way around. So given that there are probably about 90% of MPs in the House of Commons who would wish to avoid a no-deal outcome, I think they will use whatever mechanisms they have at their disposal to instruct the government to avoid that.
OK, let's take a look at the scenarios that would unfold to make that happen and what variety of them might come about. Now, firstly, if the first deal is defeated on December the 11th, do you think Theresa May is likely to resign?
That's a good question. I think Theresa May has some very difficult choices. I think there's a kind of three R's here. Her three most obvious choices are resign, concede a referendum, or go back and renegotiate. All three of those things look pretty difficult. She says there's no other deal to be renegotiated. The other EU leaders say there's no other deal to be renegotiated. So she'd have to do a U-turn to do that. She has also repeatedly said that she doesn't want to see a referendum. She's actually gone so far as to refer to a referendum as a gross betrayal of democracy, with reference to the previous referendum. But she might need to do a U-turn on that, because her other route is the resign route. I doubt, from what I can see of the woman, that that is something that she would want to do, because she clearly is extremely determined, extremely tough, and she has a very strong sense of public service. And if she resigned, we're straight into a Conservative leadership election, which would just add chaos upon chaos.
Do you think she could try, in that case, to put the deal back to Parliament for a second vote with some tweaks and nudges agreed with the European Union? Do any of those things seem likely, sufficient to change a number of people's minds in Parliament to get them to vote for it?
There's quite a lot of talk of that at the moment, and there does seem to be a growing expectation that that is what will happen. So in a sense, this vote may not be the crunch moment. The crunch moment may be when we come back to the question after Christmas. I think that that depends on a number of things. One is the size of the defeat, because if she's defeated really heavily, it may become obvious that there's no way she's going to be able to change enough people's minds to bring it back. And in terms of the renegotiation, it's not clear what there is to renegotiate. I think it would be just a few tweaks around the edges, maybe of the political declaration. The EU leaders have said they don't want to reopen the deal itself. So it would be more a matter of sort of arm twisting and persuasion between here and voting again.
She's defeated by a huge amount, so doesn't bring it back. What then happens?
Well, it's written into the legislation that she needs to come back and make a statement to Parliament within 3 weeks and propose a motion for debate within a week of that time. So we'd be in January. Come what may, whether she brings it back, that's one kind of debate that would be had, and a vote again. But if not, there would definitely be another debate on what she plans to do next. And at that point, she needs to explain what her plan of action is.
Now, there's some scenarios, presumably, in which her departure could lead to a general election.
Yes, there's a series of means by which her departure could be arrived at. Obviously, we've discussed the fact that she might resign. Another one is that she could say, I'm going to do a U-turn and go for a referendum, in which case I think it's quite likely that within her party they would reach the 48 signatures for a no-confidence vote in her within the party. And that would really be a crunch vote, because if she survived that, we'd be on course then for a referendum. She's home and dry, but she's done the U-turn. If she failed in that, we're heading for a Conservative leadership contest. The other route is that there's a vote of no confidence, not in the Conservative Party, according to their leadership rules, but actually in the House of Commons itself, moved probably by the leader of the opposition. She might well survive such a vote, but it might be that, again, she needs to negotiate with some of her backbenchers in order to bring them on side, and somehow there could be a deal on a referendum as a result of that. So there are lots of different routes here.
Let's take what has to happen for two of them. I mean, we can't get into the business of what the question would be in any referendum, and we can't get into the business of who would win an election. But to have either of them is going to happen after the date in which we're supposed to have left. So what are we going to do about that?
Yeah, well, we're tied to, at the moment, the 29th of March, when the Article 50 period ends. That can be extended with the agreement of all of the EU 27. If there were to be a major democratic incident of some kind in the UK, aka either a general election or a referendum, the noises coming from Brussels are that they would allow an extension in order to allow that. They don't want us dropping out in chaos, perhaps in the middle of an election campaign or a referendum campaign.
How quickly could they make an agreement between the 27 to agree to an extension of Article 50?
Probably within days it would be agreed. And of course, a referendum in particular, a general election potentially or a referendum, could lead to us remaining in the EU. And actually, a lot of EU leaders would like to see that. So quite aside from the fact that they want to not stand in the way of a democratic process in the UK, if they think there's a possibility that this will result in us remaining, they're actually quite happy to facilitate that, I think.
Meg Russell, thank you very much. It's not easy to sum up this programme, but I suppose we have to say that A no-deal scenario is incredibly risky, whoever you speak to, that Parliament will do everything it can to avoid it, that Mrs May's deal is unlikely to succeed, and that one way or another, it is pretty possible that we'll end up asking Europe for an extension of Article 50. Well, my thanks to Meg Russell, to Tim Durrant, to Alex Barker, to Patrick Smith. We'll be back next week. Until then, goodbye and good luck. The Briefing Room was presented by me, David Aronovich, and produced by Tim Mansell, Serena Tarling and Tom Hill. And you can subscribe to The Briefing Room via BBC Sounds, and you can let us know what you think about it by writing a review or rating us on your podcast provider.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.